Did you know Christ Hold Fast and 40 Minutes in the Old Testament are listener-supported endeavors? They are, and if you would like to support us, you can go over to ChristHoldFast.org and go to the support page where you can make a one-time donation or a reoccurring donation of any amount. This would really help us keep doing what we're doing and enable us to do more things. Thank you for your support. Enjoy the show. Welcome to episode 34. We've done 34 of these bad boys. We are still in Genesis. This is 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. I'm Daniel Emery Price, and I am joined by Brandon Hansen, who is back after 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Yes, and of course, Chad Bird.
Hey, everybody. Good to be here.
Yes. And
good to have Brandon back, too.
I know, right? We're full strength, and it's a good thing. We were just talking about how absolutely unrehearsed we are.
We have the Bible in front of us.
That's it.
Scripture alone.
Scripture alone. I've been awake for a limited amount of time. Yeah, but so where are we in that Bible?
We're in chapter 24 of Genesis. It's a long chapter. My goodness, I'm looking at 67 verses here, so it's one of the longest chapters, if not the longest chapter in Genesis. Talks about Rebecca and Isaac and how they came to be husband and wife. So got a lot of good stuff in front of us.
All right. Well, let's dive into that. Romance and all, like, let's get some of that old school romance.
Yeah, this is definitely old school romance. it's really a remarkable story for a number of reasons. There's a first occasion that something happens in this account. We'll get to that in a minute. There's the second mention in the Bible of love between two people. We actually have the first mention in Genesis 22, where Isaac is called the son whom Abraham loves. And it's in this chapter, chapter 24, where we have reference second time to love. And this is the love between a husband and wife, between Isaac and Rebecca. So it is a love story, but it's a very much of a retro love story.
This is dating advice for all you single Christian guys out there. Yeah. I want you all to try to pull I want you to pull this off.
Yeah, but before you start dating, though, you need to acquire a lot of camels. It's one of the things this story teaches us. So here we are, just kind of catch us up on the narrative. Chapter 23 described in great detail the death and the burial of Sarah. We talked about that last time. Sarah dies, and Abraham owns no land. And so we have him negotiating with one of the local inhabitants, one of the Hittites, and he purchases the only plot of ground that he will ever own during his lifetime. And it's a field with a cave in it that serves as a burial site. So this becomes the only property owned by the patriarch, even though he's been promised by God that he will own the whole land. And anyway, so that was chapter 23. And when we end with chapter 24, we are first told that Abraham was old, advanced in years, and the Lord had blessed Abraham in every way. You know, really, in many ways, chapter 22, where Abraham took Isaac to sacrifice him on Mount Moriah, that was really the pinnacle of the part of Abraham in the story. Because from here on out, his significance, his centrality in his own story begins to fade. And Isaac takes more and more prominence. And it's really in this chapter that Abraham will be moved to the side, and his son Isaac, the promised one, will take center place. And when we get to the next chapter is where we have actually the recorded death of Abraham. It's also in this chapter, in chapter 24, where Abraham says his last recorded words, which we will get to in a moment. So Abraham's old, and we note at the beginning that the Lord had blessed Abraham in every way. That's significant because we're going to see some of these blessings delineated in the rest of the chapter. But here's the situation. Of course, Abraham and Sarah were both old when Isaac was born, and Isaac is still single. He's 40 years old, and no wife has been acquired for him, which is pretty remarkable in and of itself. But the reason that that Isaac doesn't have a wife is because Abraham was extremely selective. He wasn't going to let Isaac marry just anyone he wanted. You know, the girl down the street, the Canaanite or the Hittite down the street. Abraham was very specific about where Isaac's wife was to come from. And that's what the rest of this story is going to describe to us. So what we begin with in these first few verses is this very strange promise, oath kind of ceremony that takes place between Abraham and his servant. This is his chief servant. Abraham calls this head servant, it's the oldest servant in his household, probably Eleazar of Damascus. And this servant is the one who has charge of everything that Abraham owns at this point. Presumably, Abraham is not able to manage on affairs anymore, and so he's put this servant in charge. And here's this odd ceremony that takes place. Abraham tells the servant, "Please place your hand under my thigh, and I will make you swear by the Lord, the God of heaven and the God of earth, that you shall not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I live, but you shall go to my country and to my relatives and take a wife for my son Isaac." Now, immediately the servant is he's thinking in his mind, well, what if this happens? So he says, "Well, suppose the woman will not be willing to follow me to this land. Should I take your son back to the land from where you came?" And Abraham is emphatic here. He says, "Beware lest you take my son back there. The Lord, the God of heaven, who took me from my father's house and from the land of my birth and who spoke to me and who swore to me saying, 'To your descendants I will give this land,' he will send his angel before you and you will take a wife for my son from there. But if the woman is not willing to follow you, then you shall be free from this my oath. Only don't take my son back there." And then it wraps up with this ninth verse. "So the servant placed his hand under the thigh of Abraham, his master, and swore to him concerning this matter." Now, I could be wrong here, but it sounds like Abraham's pretty serious about Isaac not going back to the land of his birth. He's pretty emphatic that is not to take place. So what's going on here in this ceremony? Now, first of all, we have to talk just a minute here about this odd physical act that takes place when Abraham has his servant swear this oath. He says, "Please place your hand under my thigh and swear." And then when we get to the ninth verse, after Abraham has said everything that he has to say, the servant places his hand under the thigh of Abraham, his master, and swore to him concerning this matter. Now, what's the deal with the thigh? Well, actually, it's almost a universal agreement among the interpreters, and we have this image used elsewhere in the scriptures that it's really not the thigh we're talking about. That this is a euphemism for Abraham's male organ, for his penis. Now that's, I know this is pretty strange stuff.
That's not how I shake hands.
No, this is a bit of an oddity. I was reading through this and reading through the commentators this morning and looking at some other references that occur elsewhere. And yeah, I'd have to agree. I even read Luther on this, and Luther is in agreement with this as well, that we're not talking about a thigh. We're talking about something else.
Just trying to tone the thing down.
Yeah. This is trying to tone the thing down. This is a euphemism. This is another way of saying something else. Now think about this. All right. Now Now, this is weird. Yeah, this is not the way we shake hands. We don't do things these ways, this way. And in fact, there's no other reference to this particular kind of ceremony taking place in the rest of the scriptures. But it does here. Now, this might not be so odd if we think about Abraham's life, and in particular about what Abraham has been promised and commanded. Keep in mind that this isn't the first time we've heard about Abraham's male organ. We had a whole chapter about this. When you get to Genesis 17, the whole chapter could be titled, What God Told Abraham to Do with His Penis. I mean, it was all about circumcision, right? We have this ceremony, this what we might call a sacrament, that it's just weird. It's strange that God would choose to remove the foreskin of Abraham as the sign of the covenant. But you got to, you can't spiritualize the scriptures. This is very physical, fleshly kind of stuff. And that's the way God works. God is always working with just, ordinary, bodily, fleshly, earthy stuff. Now, why was he so concerned with circumcision? Why is Abraham so concerned here with him placing his hand, quote unquote, under his thigh? Because what is the promise that Abraham has given over and over? The promise concerns his seed. And I don't know if I said this before, but the Hebrew word zerah, which means seed, is the same word for sperm. So this is not a seed you plant in the ground. This is a seed that you plant in a woman's womb. So the promise all along has been connected with offspring, which is called seed. And this seed, as we talked about several times, is ultimately the Messiah. So Abraham has been promised seed in the terms of Isaac, but he's also promised a capital S seed. And that seed is already the one promised in Genesis 3:15, the seed of the woman who will crush the head of the serpent and whose heel will be bruised by the serpent's fangs. Now, with all of that in mind, why would Abraham have his servant place his hand, quote unquote, under his thigh? You still can't get past the fact that he put his hand there. I get that.
Well, I mean, obviously, this is about taking out the legal document. It's like taking out like the thing saying, "See this right here? Like this was signed by somebody with X amount of authority. So This is legit."
Yeah,
that's the legal document, man. Like this is I got the papers right here.
Right. Yeah. Well, that is it. I mean, the legal document, the legal organ, if you will, the promise was attached to Abraham's body. From Abraham's body would come forth the promised seed. And so when Abraham sends his servant on this mission, he's not just sending him on a mission. Hey, go choose a really good girl for my son to marry. You got to look at this story and the whole where it fits in the whole biblical narrative. Because this Isaac, this promised seed, is going to marry a woman, and they will have a child together who will continue to carry forth physically the promise of the seed who is to come. And so he doesn't say just, choose a Canaanite or a Hittite or a Perizzite or some other good-looking girl that can get along with Isaac that's going to be a good wife. No, I want you to choose a wife from my own family, because it is to me and to my family that the promise has been given of the seed who is to come. And yeah, this is the legal document, if you will. I mean, it's from Abraham's body that the seed is going to come.
Lutherans like to say, remember your baptism. This is remember your circumcision move right here.
Mm-hmm. That's what it is. It is. And what this circumcision means, what it has bestowed, because it's by circumcision that they are brought into the blessings of the covenant. And so in remembering his circumcision, Abraham is remembering the promise that God has given to him. And this promise will be passed down from Isaac and then to Jacob and from Jacob to his 12 sons, and then eventually to the tribe of Judah and David, and from them will come forth the Messiah. So in a very weird, uncomfortable sort of way, the action that this servant is told by Abraham to take is Abraham's way of ensuring that this promise will be kept, that his servant will get a wife for Isaac from the right people and bring her back so that Isaac can pass forth the promise of the seed, which is connected with Abraham's own circumcision.
A little strange, but good for us to be uncomfortable, especially when the promises are all ultimately they're being preserved in Abraham's family for us. This is all connected to his loins, connected to the land that he insists Isaac remain in. And this is for the church, ultimately for the church to come forth from.
Yeah, that's what this is all about. I mean, this is, the promise is physically, integrally related to Abraham. And because of that, everything that happens sexually, everything that happens with marriage, everything that happens with offspring has messianic significance. And it's nonetheless true in this case as well. So when we as the church read this, yeah, we might first think, God, this is so strange. This is so strange that he would touch him there and that the promise would be attached there. But the promise of the Messiah is a physical promise. The very first time it was given in Genesis 3:15, God was talking about physicality. And that's something that we, I think, in our spiritualizing way often forget. God's promise is always flesh and blood. God's promise is the incarnate Son of God, flesh and blood, who was a male, who himself was circumcised. So the physicality of God's promises cannot be stressed enough. And the biblical narrative brings that home again and again and again to us, as it does here.
It's good to see, after all the times that Abraham has compromised and backpedaled and gone this way or that way that was contrary to the will of God, and God still had grace on him, it's good to see him stand his ground in what may be some of his last moments here, certainly his last moments in Scripture, as an act of standing on God's word and God's promises. Before, he had Sarah to remind him of these things, and now it's come time for him to stand his ground on this. And he does so as a reflective picture of God, who lovingly provides for his son now, wants to provide him with a wife and wants to provide him with a family that he'll need to carry on.
I think it's funny that is he like 40 years old, no wife? God is like, he's like, all right, Abraham, I'm going to have you be insane old where I'm going to give you a son. And then I'm just like, I'm not going to give that son a wife until it's starting to feel like things are not really panning out that well. This is how he rolls, man. Abraham's like, is this guy going to get married? Like, am I going to have any peace about this? Or, like, I mean, the guy's like 40 years old now, and like, he doesn't have a wife, and that's the only kid I got going on. And man, this dude is like this God. He tarries, man. Like he takes his
big
sweet
time. Yeah, and even when as we'll get to this later on, but even once Isaac and Rebecca are married, she can't have children. So Isaac has to pray for that. So yeah, God is always tarrying. Peter says he's not slow to keep his promises, as some understand slowness, but from the human perspective, he is, because very few things seem to happen just immediately with God. He has this way of drawing things out so that we might learn to live a life of faith. And Brandon, you're right. I mean, with the checkered past that Abraham has, it is good in these his twilight years to see him sticking with what he should do. And in fact, these are his last recorded words. His last recorded words are there in verses, the verses leading up to 8. And I also like the fact that in his last recorded words, God will send his angel before you, talking to a servant, and you will take a wife for my son from there. So in his closing words, he makes reference to the angel of God, to God's promises, to the necessity of finding the right wife for Isaac so that he and she together might carry forth the promise of the seed. So Abraham's closing words have to do with the Messiah, with this promised seed who is to come. A lot of good stuff. Well, let's continue the story because we still have quite a ways to go. Picking up with verse 10 then, this documents for us with quite a bit of detail, an unusual, for the Bible anyway, an unusual amount of detailed information and even repetition in the story of how this servant finds a wife for Isaac. So here's what happens. This servant takes this entourage. He's got 10 camels from Abraham's herd. He takes all these treasures from his master's house, and he goes to Mesopotamia, to the city of Nahor. And this is close to where Abraham's family lives. They live in this vicinity. And here's what happens. When he gets there, he goes outside the city where there's a well of water, and it's evening. It's the time when the women would go out to the well to draw water. And here we have, interestingly, the first recorded prayer in Scripture where a servant of God is praying for guidance and success on an endeavor to which his master has sent him. So you have the servant sizing up the situation. He knows what he's been sent to do, and he stops and he says this prayer, and it's a pretty remarkable prayer. He says, "O Lord, the God of my master Abraham, please grant me success today and show loving kindness to my master Abraham. Behold, I am standing by the spring, and the daughters of the men of the city are coming out to draw water. Now may it be that the girl to whom I say, 'Please let down your jar so that I may drink,' and who answers, 'Drink, and I will water your camels also,' may she be the one whom you have appointed for your servant Isaac. And by this I shall know that you have shown loving kindness to my master." Now, it's a pretty remarkable prayer because the servant is looking at the situation. He knows his mission. And what he basically is asking God to do is to guide the situation so that it will be obvious to him who it is that he should choose to be Isaac's wife. And he has a plan. This is the plan that he lays out here. So she not only will offer me water, but she will offer to water my camels as well. And story goes on. It came about before he had finished speaking. So this is while he's finishing up his prayer. He hasn't even finished praying what he was saying to God when, behold, Rebekah, who was born to Bethuel, the son of Milcah, the wife of Abraham's brother Nahor, Rebekah came out with her jar on her shoulder. Goes on to say she was very beautiful, a virgin, had no relations with a man, and she came down to the spring and filled her jar and came up. So here's what happens. So the servant, he sees her, and he runs out to meet her, and he's, of course, he's got this plan, and so he says to her, "Please let me drink a little water from your jar." And then she says, "Drink, my lord." And she quickly loaded her jar to her hand and gave him a drink. And then, after he had drunk, she said, "I will also draw for your camels until they have finished drinking." So she empties the water jar into the trough. She runs back to the well to draw more, and she drew water for all his camels. Now, how much water does a camel drink?
Seems like a lot.
It is a lot. Well,
two humps worth a piece.
From what I've read, after a long journey, camels will drink up to 25 gallons of water. That's a lot of water. And he has 10 camels.
250 gallons.
Yeah, this is a lot of water for Rebecca to be drawing for this complete stranger. Now, I think this is significant. One of the attributes that we saw of Abraham, and one of the attributes that is extremely important in this culture, is hospitality. And so I believe what's going on here with the servant, the reason he sets things up the way he does, the way he prays the way he does, is because he's looking for a wife for Isaac who is going to be a reflection of what was significant to Abraham's family as well. And one of those was hospitality to strangers, a willingness to love your neighbor, to reach out to those who are around you with help and with love. And that's what Rebecca does right away. She wasn't socially obligated, in other words, to do what she offers to do for this stranger, but she does it anyway. She goes out of her way to assist Abraham's servant and to water his camels as well. So what happens then? The man is looking at her in silence, it says. So he's trying to figure out if she is the answer to his prayers. He wants to know whether the Lord has made his journey successful or not. So when the camels had finished drinking, he takes out a gold ring that weighs half a shekel and two bracelets for her wrist that weighed 10 shekels in gold. And he asks her who her family is. Whose daughter are you? He says, please tell me, is there room for us to lodge in your father's house? And it's then that he learns who she is, that she is, in fact, as she says, the daughter of Bethuel, the son of Milcah, whom she bore to Nahor. And then she offers to take them into her home and to give them and the camels food to eat and a place to lodge. And it says in verse 26 that the man bowed low and worshiped the Lord and said, blessed be the Lord, the God of my master Abraham, who has not forsaken his loving kindness and his truth toward his master. As for me, the Lord has guided me in the way to the house of my master's brothers. So he goes on this long journey, and he goes to the well. He prays the prayer, and before he's even finished praying the prayer, Rebecca comes up, and as he discovers, as the rest of the scene unfolds, she is in fact the one that the Lord has designated for Isaac. It's an awesome story. Is that the way you guys met your wives?
That's exactly how it went down.
The well is the place to meet your wife, biblically speaking.
It really is.
It is, yeah. I mean, this is the first one. Jacob is going to meet his wife near the well. When Moses flees Egypt, he goes to a well, and that's where he meets the seven daughters of the priest of Midian, and he ends up marrying Zipporah, one of those daughters. Now, I was thinking about this morning. Isn't it interesting that when you get to the Gospels, that one of the recorded stories about Jesus that takes place at a well has to do with a conversation he has with a woman and marriage? It's as if wells have this quality about them that draws out either proposals or falling in love or discussions of marriage. But that is one of the biblical themes that you can trace. You can trace all the way from Genesis to the Gospel of John. Something about water draws people together.
Yeah, I met my wife at a outdoor rock concert.
Was there a well close by?
There was like a beer garden. Does that count?
Yeah, that counts. That counts. That'll work. What about you, Brandon? A well?
No, not a well. At a Sunday school, actually.
Oh, okay. We have a rock concert and a Sunday school.
When we were very young and we didn't have any clue what was going on or what our futures would entail.
Yeah. And people are like, I knew there was a fundamental difference between Brandon and Daniel.
We've just discovered it.
Brandon is much more righteous.
I sojourned many years in the wilderness, and then I returned.
Oh, Well, I hope anybody who's listening to this, if they are single and are looking for a spouse, will consider checking out Wells as one possibility as a place to find their future spouse.
I can't help but notice just one thing, though, that might be a reflection of the church here, and I might just be digging for gold. We'll see if I find it. There's always something going on with God and water. It's always there that he seems to be working. And here, Rebecca, a picture of the church, that Isaac, a picture of the Son of God. This is where the fundamental meeting takes place, where perhaps the evangelist goes working with or around water, finds Rebecca, and there she receives gifts. In the same way, I feel like when we go and we receive from living waters at our church, from the Word of God, get to see baptisms, and we get to, that's where we were baptized mostly. That's where we receive the body and blood of Christ. We receive gifts there. In the same way, Rebecca's receiving gifts here at the waters.
Yeah, that's a great point to make, and I would agree wholeheartedly. One of the things that we have to do when we're reading these stories is look at the trees as well as the forest. I mean, we have to look at it specifically, but we also have to look at it in its overall biblical context. And that's exactly what you're bringing out there, that God is consistently working to give his people blessings and gifts in connection with water. You know, I was thinking of the last chapter of Revelation as well, where you have this beautiful description of Christ and his bride, resplendent, coming down out of heaven. But in that same context, you have this Eden imagery where the Lord and the Lamb are in their temple, and what flows from the temple but the river of life. And this river of life is the means by which God gives life to all creation. So God and his people and water and his gifts are a theme that you can trace over and over from Genesis, the story of the Exodus and the Red Sea and the water from the rock, all the way to the closing chapters of the scriptures. Because it's in water and to water that God joins his word of promise. And from that word of promise working through the water, we are given the gifts of the kingdom. And we're made part of the bride of Christ, part of his body, the church.
Yeah, yeah.
So let's talk about the rest of the story here. It goes on actually quite a while. I'll summarize portions of this so that we can make sure we cover the whole story. So he's identified Rebecca. He's found out what family she's from. He's given her these gifts. And it's here that we're introduced to a character that's going to come up later on. It's our friend Laban. Now, Laban, where does he come up later on?
Oh, man, Laban is a guy that you definitely want involved in all aspects of your marriage.
Yeah. He's the future brother-in-law. He's the brother of Rebecca. And it's hard for me, at least knowing the rest of the story of Laban and how he was involved with, of course, Jacob later on when Jacob went to live with him. 14, it's hard for 14. Me to read the story about Laban without assuming that he had dollar signs in his eyes, because he's evidently, so here's what happens. He's evidently kind of in charge of the family. His dad is we're assuming is older and isn't able to really care for the household anymore. And so Laban's kind of taking charge. He's the brother of Rebecca. Well, Rebecca goes and she tells, it says, her mother's household, what everything that just happened. You know, this guy shows up and he's got 10 camels and all this stuff. And look, he gave me this gold and these wonderful things. And Laban runs to meet the man at the spring. he can't get there fast enough. And he says, you know, he says, come in, blessed of the Lord. Why do you stand outside? I've prepared the house and I've got a place for your camels and everything. So Laban can't wait to get this guy to his house because he sees the opportunities that they have here. You know, that is one of the reasons that Abraham sent a very, very impressive entourage with his servant. I mean, 10 camels loaded down with goods. This is more than just, you know, paying a bride price. This is extravagance because God had been gracious to Abraham. I mean, he did carry off a whole bunch of riches from Egypt and then later from Abimelech. So he's a wealthy dude. He's got plenty to use to impress the family and to make sure that he gets the bride that he wants for his son. But Laban notices this right away. Laban is eager to invite him in. So anyway, pick up the story. They go in to eat, but the servant won't eat until he has his say. And what he says is basically, he repeats the story. So this is who I am. This is who I serve. I serve Abraham. God has richly blessed Abraham. He's become rich. He has flocks and herds and silver and gold and servants and maids and camels and donkeys. So he's done extremely well for himself. And I came here to find a wife for my master's son, his only son, whom he loves. And then he repeats the story. This is what happened. I got here. This is what I prayed to God. And then as I was praying, behold, this is what happened. And so this is what I want. I would like to take Rebecca home with me to be the wife of my master's son. And he wraps it up by basically saying, tell me yes or no. If you tell me yes, we'll get this done. If you tell me no, then I'll look elsewhere. And we have in the 50th verse the response of Laban and his father, Bethuel. They answered and said, the matter comes from the Lord, so we cannot speak to you bad or good. In other words, it's obvious. It's obvious that this is what God has set up. So we're good with it.
Can you imagine spending 14 Thanksgivings with Laban? It's the worst.
No, I can't. I can't imagine spending one Thanksgiving with Laban.
I feel like if I was concerned about my bride getting to the altar, I could trust Laban with that duty. Just make sure that she gets there tomorrow morning at this time.
Make sure
it's the right one. There's a bunch of others that are,
yeah. Unveiled, yeah. I would not trust Laban to bring a veiled bride to my wedding. Because when I lifted the veil to kiss the bride, I might be looking at Leah instead of Rachel. I don't know. Maybe I suppose I'm reading a lot into Laban's personality based on what we know about him from later on. But I think that's fair to do because we are given the rest of the story about Laban. We do know what is important to him. We do know he can be very deceptive and very upset when he doesn't get his own way. So I expect that he was very impressed with all this wealth.
Yeah, dude. I mean, it's hard to put any kind of spin on what Laban does. I mean, we're jumping way ahead, but what Laban does to Jacob is about as cold as it gets, man. That's really.
Yeah. The only humor I find, in that story, is that Jacob, who was such a deceiver. Right. Was finally deceived. that's the only humor that I could find in that story. The deceiver was deceived by Laban. And, yeah, in a very real cold way. I mean, no one wants to wake up the morning after the wedding and discover that they have the wrong bride.
That's a long con right there.
It is a long con, yeah. And then he pretends as if Jacob should have known, oh, well, it's the custom in our country of course, it's always the older of the daughters who's married first. So you should have known that.
This is on you, man.
This is on you. Yeah. Blame shifting.
And we're out of time.
Oh, yep. 40 minutes is over. All right. I thought we were going to finish the story. We'll wrap it up next week then.
Yeah. We got distracted by the Laban's history. So, well, guys, thanks for joining us. And we will, in fact, wrap this up next time. And so we will see you then.